What we're going to be talking about in the next 55 minutes is the challenge of the campus today. I must tell you that Elmer Witt selected that overall theme. A good friend, Elmer, colleague in campus ministry for many years, colleague on our national staff team, mentor, friend, all that Elmer has meant to all of you, he's meant to me, and he is much loved. He made the topic broad enough so that you could do almost anything with it. Rather than simply give you a campus ministry rehash, I've got people like Mike here who would try and keep me honest, so rather than do that, I thought I'd take an approach and try and deal with some very general challenges of the campus today, which hopefully would have a hook in with all of us. I was going to do a little exercise here, and maybe we'll do it. Are any of you enrolled in college right now? Okay. Are any of you parents of a son or daughter who ever went to college? Okay. Have you attended college yourself at some time, or do you hope to attend someday? Are you concerned about higher education? Well, I think you get the point that obviously we have some commonality and some interest in the whole arena of what's going on the campus today. What I've chosen to do is to take this in five basic parts, and today we'll be talking about the challenge of struggle, and hopefully we will see that struggles highlight possibilities as well as problems. And then tomorrow we'll talk about the challenge of ideas. And the Episcopalians made up a poster a few years ago which said, Jesus died to take away our sins, not our minds. And when we deal with the whole challenge of ideas, it has something to do with faith and reason and the tension that exists there. The next day we'll be talking about the challenge of identity. And this is not simply our personal identity, although that will come into our discussion. Rather, we'll be talking about we as a community of believers, we as Lutherans, and are we in fact an organization since we're talking about a new church these days, or are we a movement? The next day we'll talk about protest, the challenge of protest, because on one given day there were spontaneous protests at 60 different campuses across the country, basically centered on one issue. So we'll try to take a look at protest and what the relationship is between protest and values and prophecy. And then we'll wind up our discussion on the challenge of the campus today by taking a look at the challenge to ministry. And that has something to do with the community of the called and their vocation. What I propose to do is let you in on a few secrets on who I am. I'm going to give you a model that you can use for doing some sharing with other people. All of us wear masks. The university wears a mask. And our task is going to be to peel away a few layers of that and see if we can't gain some understandings of what the university is about and some of the challenges that are there. All of us wear masks, and we don't tell all that we would like to tell, or maybe that we dare to tell about ourselves. And you heard that couched in the Bible study hour when Ed Schrader talked about fear, the fear of judgment, the fear of exposure. So what I hope to do each day is to help you understand a little bit who I am by peeling away a few layers of mask. And I'm going to do that by approaching it from two sides. We are, to a large measure, shaped by the people who have been a part of our experience. Psychology, they talk about significant others. And if we were to tell some of the people who have meant a great deal to us in our lives, the person who heard the story about those people would know a lot more about us. So I'm going to be sharing a couple different people each day who have helped to shape me. Another area or arena is place. You can learn a lot about a person simply by the places where they have been. And so each day I'm going to give you a couple of places that have been important in my life. And when you do discussing with one another, this might be a little format that you could use as well. The two people I'd like to share a little bit about today are my two grandfathers, Nels John Anderson and Ira S. Carr. Nels John was one of a large family who grew up in his early years in a place called Åland, Sweden. At the age of 12, he was put on a boat, sailing boat, and sent over to a brother who lived in Montezuma, Iowa. Now just imagine a boy of 12 not knowing a language of a country to whom or where he is destined to go, getting on a boat, getting off in New York, wending his way to Montezuma, Iowa. This was my grandfather. He was a farmer. He was crippled after an accident. And so my mother, being the only daughter in the family of seven, I had the responsibility of caring for him. So when I grew up with my grandfather in the house, and he was a member of the family, and he taught me some things in Swedish, and I used to sing Swedish songs as a boy in order to get fudgesicles down the corner downtown. He had been a tailor apprentice in Sweden, and he used to make pocketbooks. As he was crippled, he was confined to a chair and got around on crutches. And he always gave away pocketbooks to people who came to visit him. The thing that really impressed me, however, was that he was an avid Bible reader. He had basically memorized the Bible. People could walk through the room, and of course he moved his lips when he read. He kind of whispered or read a little out loud. And people would walk into the room and he would look up and watch them, and it could be for several minutes, and his lips continued to move because he knew the My other grandfather, he was one of seven sons. He was the only one who did not become a Methodist circuit rider. He was born in Wisconsin. He became a part of the Wisconsin militia and fought in the Civil War. Kind of amazing. We have framed on our wall the photo of his discharge paper. Wounded in the war, lived a life with an open wound, drank too much, wasn't able to work, had lots of kids to support him, and my dad happened to be the youngest of the lot. I never knew this grandfather, but I learned something from him through my father. My dad was a very independent person because his father was so dependent. Kind of an interesting shift. The places to let you know a little about me, the two today, the first is my hometown, a little dinky town in the state of Iowa, Gowrie, Iowa. 1,200 souls, if you count all the life, that means dogs and cats and people. Mostly Swedish ancestry. It was a good place to roam. It was a good place to explore, good place to experiment, good place to grow up. Comfortable place. Very much like many small towns, everybody had a nickname. They were pegged for certain skills that they had or certain quirks that were a part of them. Shorty, you can guess something about Shorty. Or High Pockets, you can guess something about High Pockets. My nickname was Casey. I'd been an athlete and I managed to hit a few home runs in my day, but I also managed to strike out in some crucial situations. My church in that town, it's another place, Zion Lutheran, very large, impressive building, hard-headed Swedes, strong dose of piety. I usually went to church alone. Sat in a balcony, drew pictures, but I listened. And 25 years ago, I was ordained in that same church. Now, what I propose to do in our schedule, come on in, folks, just take a seat anywhere. Each day, I'm going to deliver some thought starters for us, and I'll hopefully give you a basic outline so that you'll be able to follow where I am with my thoughts, and then I invite your challenge to those thoughts and in our discussion, hopefully centering it on the topic for today, which is struggle, and each day on the topic that we've listed for the day. Zazu Pitt said that laughter is God's hand upon a troubled world. Laughter is God's hand upon a troubled world. And there was a physician from Fordham University by the name of James J. Walsh who wrote this: "People who laugh actually live longer than those who don't laugh. Few persons realize that health actually varies according to the amount of laughter." And so each day I'm going to help us live longer. I'm going to tell a joke, and you'll be very tired of my joke, so what I'll do is invite you to jot down on a piece of paper the really good stories that you know, and we'll pass it before an impartial jury of your peers, and those who are winners, you'll be allowed to tell your story here, or if you're a little shy, you can ask someone else to tell it. The story today is about the man who walked into Chase Manhattan Bank in New York City. Any of you from New York? Have you been to Manhattan? Okay, it's a very busy place and lots of asphalt and lots of big buildings. Well, this man walked into Chase Manhattan Bank and he said he wanted to borrow $1,500. And he said he'd only need the money for a week. The banker said, "Well, what do you have for collateral?" And he took the banker to the window and he pointed out to the bank parking lot and he said, "Do you see that silver Rolls Royce down there?" He said, "That's my collateral and I'll leave it with you." And the banker said, "You own that Rolls Royce? Why in the world are you borrowing $1,500? Well, they argued back and forth. Eventually the loan was made. A week later the man came back. The bill for borrowing the $1,500 was $1,517.50. And after he'd paid off the note, the banker was so curious, he said, "Good grief, you could have written out a check for $1,500. Why did you come here and borrow $1,500? The man said, "Where else can you park in Manhattan for a week for $17.40? Okay. If you don't like my humor, make sure you get those stories in. Our theme for the day is the challenge of the campus today, as we said, and the topic is the challenge of struggle. First of all, let's take a look at the word challenge. What does challenge mean? The New Collegiate Dictionary defines it this way: an invitation to engage in a contest, a summons to fight as a duel, also a message conveying the summons. And then there's the less preferred definition, which says taking exception to or calling into question or to dare. Well, laying down the gauntlet to the university, challenge in that definition, is really not what we're talking about. Rather, we're going to use the term challenge in these days together, rather to refer to a difficult or a trying or a testy hurdle that's to be overcome. An example of this would be, for example, courses in organic chemistry or anatomy. They may be a challenge to a pre-med student. Or winning baseball games on the road or at Wrigley Field may be regarded as a challenge to the Chicago Cubs. It's in that sense that we're going to be using the word challenge. It's more like the challenge of Mount Everest. It's a mountain to be climbed. Or the challenge of space, oceans of space that are just beckoning to be crossed. And since then, it's the university which presents the challenge, and it is, in essence, a difficult and a testy and a trying hurdle to be overcome if you've got a goal of doing ministry with the people who live and work and study and teach and administer and do research and create things in that place, the university. The challenge of struggle. struggle is kind of an N word in academic circles these days, just as it's a word that's commonly used in political circles. And we live in a world which is dominated by struggle. A struggle between the West, which is represented by the United States and its philosophy of democratic capitalism, and the East, which is represented by the Soviet Union with their philosophy of dialectical materialism. So the word struggle is a commonly used word and a popular word these days. Now, what does the dictionary have to say about struggle? What does struggle mean? The dictionary says that struggle is a violent effort with contortions of the body, to use great efforts, to labor hard, to strive. Now, the word was probably used long before Karl Marx and Friedrich Engels wrote the Communist Manifesto, but the word struggle has certainly been popularized or in greater use since that book appeared in the 1880s. The concept of struggle, I think, is key if you're going to understand dialectical materialism and why there is this East-West Cold War that exists and that dominates so much of our livelihood these days. Now, the ideas of Marx have always enjoyed their greatest following among intellectuals, we know that. But most Americans know very little about Marx or Marx's ideas. I think we should learn more about dialectical materialism. Why? In order to understand what in the world is going on around us in the world. There are huge forces that are coming into play and causing all kinds of things to happen everywhere in the world. And it's in everyone's best interest if we understand a little bit more about these forces and what are some of the things beneath, when you peel away a few layers of the mask again, what's really there. Let's take a couple minutes and just talk a little bit about that then. This is not to be anything but a thumbnail sketch of dialectical materialism, and that's again to help us to understand struggle, a word that Marx has at least helped us to use much more frequently in these days. Well, Marx and Engels said that the world is in a continual process of development and change. And they said that this change is dialectical. And what this means is that these changes proceed through an established pattern, a pattern of affirmation, or they call it a thesis. A statement is made or an affirmation is made, and as soon as that affirmation is made, it's denied by someone. They deny the affirmation and they call that antithesis. And no sooner is this denial of the thesis than the two start moving together. And that's called a synthesis. A thesis, an antithesis, and a synthesis. And a simple way to realize what Marx and Engels were talking about, incidentally, struggle is what goes on between each one of those. That's what we're getting at. Is to take the idea of being. This is the thesis, the idea of existence or of being. And as soon as you think of being, we're talking about an idea now, you have the idea of non-being. Every thesis has its opposite or its negative. And as soon as you start talking about being and non-being, somehow you try to put those two together. And then you come up with a word, becoming. Something between being and non-being. This is the essence of all development and change, and it involves struggle, according to Marx. According to Marx, history is interpreted as a record of class struggle. Class struggle. And in this time of industrial capitalism, the struggle, he said, is between the bourgeoisie, or the people who own things, the owning group, and the proletariat. These are the people who do the working, the wage earners. He said, that's where the struggle is taking place in this portion of God's time. And he reasoned that since this owning class controls the key institutions in society, and they really won't permit any thoroughgoing changes by peaceful means, he says the only alternative is the forcible overthrow of all the existing social conditions. Of course, this was the ideology that was adopted by Lenin and his followers in the Communist Party. Think of South Africa today. Class struggle. Group of people who have control over the key institutions in the society. Is peaceful change possible? That white minority is saying, but look at all the progress. You can't go too fast. The whole issue of apartheid. And the majority black community and some voices within that community are saying, no, it doesn't work that way. And they may adopt this Marxist analysis, which says we're in a struggle and change only comes by this dialectical process, and it can't come peaceably. Because the bourgeoisie, the owners, are not about to give up peacefully. This is the world that we live in. This is part of the challenge of struggle. Marx catapulted the word struggle into our vocabulary. And it ought to be in our vocabulary. If we're going to, in any way, understand what's going on about us. Now we know that there can indeed be growth through struggle. A couple of examples, Mr. Universe, I guess there are a couple flicks out now about male and female bodybuilders. You all know how that happens, don't you? It basically happens through struggle. You know, diet figures in and a few other things, but the basic way you build muscles is the same whether you use a weight or a stationary object or an imaginary object. We call it isometrics when we use imaginary objects. You can stretch your muscles by pushing against a stationary, struggle your muscle as it were. Or if you've got a real live weight, that's a real struggle, just to pitch your muscles against that mass. Struggle is how things grow. We know that. When I was a boy, I remember looking at the comic books, and I was a 97-pound weakling, like everybody else. And I saw the ads about the boy and his girlfriend on the beach, and the bully runs by and kicks sand on him, and he can't do anything about it, but he sends in to Charles Atlas, and he runs right home and stands before the mirror. It was called dynamic tension. I sent in for that course. And it was struggle. You pitted muscle against muscle. You know, you did certain things. And it worked. Your muscles did grow because of struggle. We know that struggle yields growth. Question is, and the challenge is that the only way? Is struggle the only way that growth happens? It seems to me a lot of it depends on how you look at struggle. You see, is the glass half empty or half full? Struggle can be viewed as the human condition, as Marx did, or it can be viewed as simply a part of what it means to be human. I think there's a line in the film Elvira Madigan that says it about as well as any in terms of whether the glass is half full or half empty. The line is, a blade of grass can cover the whole world if it's close enough to your eye. A blade of grass can cover the whole world if it's close enough to your eye. What I'm saying is, we can't get so hung up with struggle that we can't see anything else. I think that's maybe the way some folks have viewed struggle. Marx saw that life was struggle when he viewed history and social development and change. Struggle exists in nature. Just think of the animal kingdom and a thing called the survival of the fittest. Struggle goes on in the world of plants and vegetation. There's a force of gravity that's holding down, and there's a force of life that's pushing up. And there are all kinds of things to contend with in that pushing up, that life force, whether it's scorching sun, or whether it's a shortage of water, or whether it's nutrient poor soil, or doesn't make any, there are all kinds of things that cause struggle for the world of vegetation. John Henry Newman wrote that the exterior world, physical and historical, is but the manifestation of our senses of realities that are greater than itself. And he concluded by saying that nature is a parable. Nature is a parable. Malcolm Muggeridge commented on this observation of Newman, that nature is a parable. This is what Muggeridge said. Everything that happens to us or in connection with us, all the happenings of the world, great and small, the whole exterior phenomena of nature and of life, all that amounts to God speaking to us, sending us messages in code, and faith is the key whereby we may decipher them. Everything's a parable. It's all in a code. And the key to the code, the key to understanding this parable of all of nature and all of life is faith. Muggeridge goes on to allude to that wonderful passage in John's gospel account about the Word which became flesh and came to dwell among us full of grace and truth. And this is what Muggeridge wrote. The Word which became flesh goes on being written, not with pen and paper, but in each human heart. It is, as it were, the book of life being written, a testament comprising every word spoken, every deed entertained, every suffering endured, a living volume in which is written a true revelation of God's Word, explaining it to every heart, unfolding it in every passing moment. Nature is a parable, and the struggles of the world are a parable if we have the eyes to see, if we have the eyes of faith, which are given to us as we believe by grace. We really are under the shadow of God's wing, the theme of Holden Village this summer. We really are under the shadow of God's wing when we view struggle through the eyes of faith. Now, what struggles are going on in higher education these days? As I said, I'm going to take the approach that I've done some reading and done some study in the whole area of higher education. And you probably haven't done that. So I'm going to do some sharing on the whole higher education struggle. And then in our discussion, of course, you can challenge, as I said, anything that I've said. But hopefully in our discussion, we can be a little more practical with the background and the expertise that we all have. We said most of us either were parents of college students, or we ourselves had gone to college, or we had some concern about higher education. So in our discussion, we'll talk about those more practical aspects. What I'm going to do now is tell you a little about some of the struggles that are going on in higher education today. There are many of these struggles. We don't have time to talk about a lot of them, but I'm going to talk about these that are listed here. First of all, the boom. Boom is a struggle. It's been called a quiet evolution. American education has been part of this quiet evolution that's been really occurring over the last century. Another person by the name of Ernest Boyer, who was the former U.S. Commissioner of Education and current president of the Carnegie Foundation for the Advancement of Teaching, described it a different way. Instead of evolution, he said it's a revolution unparalleled in human history. Here's a little backup data on that. In the year 1890, 3.5% of all 17-year-olds in this country were going to high school, and 1.8% of those that we call the traditional college age, 18 to 24-year-olds, were going on to college. 1.8. Now that's in 1890, that's the turn of the century. Guess what it is now, 95 years later? 75.6% of all 17-year-olds are completing secondary education in this country. Now that's a jump from 3.5% to 75%. It's an amazing jump. And the jump is from 1.8% of the traditional college age student to 40.5%. 4 out of every 10 high school graduates is going on to college somewhere. Now that's amazing. And that's in less than 100 years. It's an educational boom. There's no way to describe it that's any more accurate than that. It really is a boom. Think of what happened. I was a young pastor in California. I saw universities begin open their doors to 20,000 students, and it happened in 1 year. 1 year, San Fernando Valley. Bang, the doors opened, 20,000 students. Long Beach State was a sleepy little college in a sprawled out town. It had like 3,500 students. You turned around, all of a sudden it had almost 35,000 students. It's a boom. And this is struggle. How in the world do you accommodate to that huge influx of students? The GI Bill, an amazing thing, just generated all kinds of struggle for higher education, because how do you deal with all those people? We didn't have the physical facilities, we didn't have the teaching faculty. It created a struggle. It was a problem, but it was a possibility for higher education. Bust. There are 3,250 plus colleges and universities in the United States today. They enroll over 12 million students. The combined budgets of these higher education institutions is more than $60 billion annually. But the problem is a little bit different today. We talked, first of all, about this huge influx of students. We're in a different day today. Demographics indicate that the student pool of this traditional age student, 18 to 24, is going down. By 1997, this age group will be 23.5% lower than what it was in 1980. Almost one-fourth. And that's just the pool that you draw from. The next thing I'm going to talk about is how in the world do you attract even that lowered pool that you have? You know what the economists are saying? They're predicting that even more of this available pool of students is not going to choose college. They based that prediction on what they call the rate of return financially on a college education. It's gone down 50% in just the last 15 years. Now we're talking about from 1970 to 1985, it's gone down 50%. Now this is the way the economists deal with this statistic. They call it the private economic rate of return. And the way they figure that, it's on the cost of a student to go to college, but they also have to figure in the loss of income. In other words, if they hadn't gone to college and they had a job. And that, those are the two factors that they work into to reach their conclusion. And they're saying that today it isn't all that profitable to go to college. Now, I'm going to give you another statistic in a minute, which gets even more frightening. There was a researcher at UCLA by the name of Alexander Aston, and he sent out a questionnaire to 192,000 freshman students across the country. The largest single response, 76% of those persons, of those 192,000 persons, responded to this question, why are you going to college? Guess what they answered? 76% for the ability to get a better job. And yet, I just said, the economists are saying that when you start sharpening your pencil, all of a sudden you discover that it isn't all that profitable to go to college. And we're talking about a smaller pool. You see, this is called struggle. This is what higher education is going through today. Enrollment is the name of the game. Student enrollment is the name of the game. Ask any of the colleges of the church. Why is Dana College marginal? Very simple. If it had the student enrollment of St. Olaf or Wartburg, it wouldn't be marginal. Just over 400 students, and the wolf is at the door. You go to 2,000 students, or 4,000 like Valparaiso University, it becomes less of a problem. Student enrollment is the name of the game. The struggle of survival is not simply boom and bust. It has to do with some shifts today. That's part of the struggle in higher education. The shift, for example, I put a dollar sign here. The shift is from federal funding of higher education more towards state funding of higher education. And you know what the problem with that is. I mean, it isn't simply in the area of higher education that the shift is taking place. I mean, states are now responsible for all kinds of social services that the feds used to take care of. Highway monies aren't there with that same generosity, and you see a strip of concrete that stops and no hope of continuing it on. There's been a shift of dollars away from federal funding to state funding. Now, the picture is further complicated by a shift on the part of attitudes. The attitudes of parents toward a college education for their children. You see, a number of years ago, this was really the goal of parents. It was the goal of that immigrant group that came across in the late 1800s and early 1900s to our shores. Those immigrants who came from the Scandinavian countries, the Nordic countries, Germany, Europe, they sacrificed. They sacrificed to build colleges in the first place. They sacrificed so that their kids in this new world could break out of some of the classes that they had been bound and chained to in the old country. And now what we've seen is a shift. A shift with a more hedonistic attitude on the part of parents. And again, it's the economists who have noted this for us. They talk about high income elasticity. High income elasticity. What they're saying is parents are more inclined to spend their money on themselves than on their children and on an education for their children. They spend their money for travel abroad. You see, who hasn't been to Europe? Who hasn't been to Greece? They spend it on a second and a third car. They spend it to join the country club. High income elasticity. And then there's a lower elasticity for spending money on education for their children. It's easy to point this up in just in terms of federal support for students. You realize in the last 20 years, the support for students, federal support, has gone up 9 times? Now that's a lot of money. 9 times. And so a shift has taken place. Rather than parents sacrificing for their children, they're keeping the money for themselves. And the feds have picked up the price tag, in a sense. Students. When I was a student, I could put myself through school, and I did. My kids, no longer possible today. They can work as hard as they want to at $3.50 an hour, and they just can't do it. Somebody's got to assist them. They can apply for Pell Grants, they can apply for any of the student aids, they can apply for work study. There's got to be some help along the way. Mom and Dad will kick in, and they do. There's got to be some help along the way. And I'm saying that a shift has taken place. A shift in attitudes. Another struggle in higher education occurred after 1957. You know what happened in 1957?
Sputnik.
The liberal arts had been king of the hill in the university world. That was prior to the 1960s, and I'm sure you remember John F. Kennedy giving that initial announcement. Now, we're going to do this thing in space. We are going to have a person not only walking on the moon, but coming back. And so there was a huge shift from the liberal arts to the sciences. Lots of federal dollars pumped into the sciences. We were going to surpass the Soviets, and we did. The goal was reached. Now, the latest shift has been the new emphasis on individual economic advancement through concentration by students on vocational subjects rather than on the humanities. You see the shift from liberal arts to the sciences and now to vocation or technical. Students choose their college on the basis of whether or not they can get the vocational studies that they would like, and even more than that, the placement that they would like after their technical studies. The result, very simple, it's been a decline in the humanities. It's been a huge growth in the technical and in the business areas. Humanities professors have smaller class loads, and business administration departments can't hire enough competent faculty. And the result is called a struggle by some folks. There's a great tension between faculty members. Folks who used to have bulging classrooms now are scrambling to get students. It's more than that, struggle in the whole world among universities themselves. Guess which university has the largest endowment in this country? We all know what an endowment is. That's a chunk of money that's set aside, and you can't touch the principal, but you live off the interest. And the interest goes to all kinds of things that happen within a university. You know which university has the largest endowment. Harvard University, the oldest college, 1642, the oldest college in this country. Their endowment is $2.49 billion. Guess which university has the second largest endowment?
MIT.
Any other guesses? Pardon?
Yale.
One of the Texas schools.
University of Texas has the second largest endowment. Their endowment is just below Harvard's, $2.27 billion.
They just voted to split that up among all the Texas State Universities.
Yeah, but you know who gets the lion's share? Austin. And you know who gets the second? College Station. And the rest is piddly. It's passed out in the rest of the system. What they're doing is raiding university faculty, other universities. Now, we're talking about struggle today, folks. Guess how that feels to other universities. I have a string of quotes in my my file folder on this, but other universities aren't happy. The university is rating their Nobel Prize winners. Yeah. And this is part of the struggle that's going on. Another area, the whole area of blacks in black higher education. Traditionally, blacks went to black colleges, at least the brighter blacks went to black colleges in the South. In 1965, there are 107 schools that are listed by the United Negro College Fund. And these 107 schools claimed enrollment of more than 80% of all blacks who were enrolled in institutions of higher education in the country. 107 black schools had 80% of all the blacks that were in college. Guess what? In 1982, those same 107 schools reported that of all blacks studying in colleges and universities in this country, they had not 80%, but 22% of those blacks. So the intellectually bright, those who are academically the real potentials in the world of higher education, are being skimmed. Quote, white, unquote, universities are taking away those good students. Now this is called struggle, folks. It's part of the struggle of higher education today. Another struggle. How do you provide a relevant education? In other words, one that counts, one that's going to attract people. There's been an enormous growth in proprietary schools in the last decade. These are schools that are funded not by tax dollars, but by business and industry. They're called corporate classrooms, or corporation classrooms. They are right now training 8 million people a year, which is close to the enrollment of all the four-year colleges in this country. They're spending $40 billion a year for this training versus $60 billion of our tax dollars that's going in. And private college dorms. This fall, IBM is spending over $700 million. They plan to consolidate their four technical institutes onto one 250-acre super campus just outside New York City. And you see the problem? If education is to free, can you see the problem in big business or corporations really getting their toe in the door in terms of higher education? One of the Texas Instrument executives said this: as technology changes, universities tend to lag 1 to 3 years behind what's happening in the workplace. By implication, they can't afford the university graduates, so they want to train their own. And see, if you're talking about the whole world of technology, of course they're right. And when you're talking about students who go to college to get a better job, are you starting to get the picture of the struggle that's going on in higher education? Well, these are just a few of the things which, as I say, is a thumbnail sketch view of what's going on in terms of struggle in higher education. That's the higher education end of it. What I'd like to have us do is, in our discussion, you can, of course, as I say, challenge anything that I've said or comment on it, but maybe we can focus on what in the world we're talking about in terms of the struggles for a student. What are the struggles that a student faces on the campus today? Or what are the struggles that you as parents may face today in this world? I think a key thing is what I started out with, and that's to remember that we do live under the shadow of God's wings. It does depend on how you look at that glass of water, whether it's half full or half empty. And I'm saying to you that when you think about the challenge of struggle in higher education today on the campus, the struggles ought to highlight possibilities as well as problems. Okay. Where are we? Any struggles that are going on? What's happening with students? What are some of the struggles that students face in higher education? Yes?
We've got a new struggle in Texas. Although we do have a large endowment fund, they've decided to triple our tuition this year. So that's quite a big step. And I have, like, one of my best friends won't be going back to school next year.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one of the struggles we face.
Why do you think that is? Why did the state legislature decide to triple you?
They said that they were tired of us driving around in new cars and having fancy stereos. Most of this place might be fine.
Now, triple, if you pay $1 a year tuition, triple doesn't mean much to me. If you pay $5,000 a year, then triple means a lot. What is the tuition at the University of Texas?
I don't go to UT, I go to Southwest Texas.
Okay, south of San Marcos, what is it?
I'm not really sure. It's not 5,000.
Was it a small percentage of the total cost? Relatively small?
To the quarter or semester?
Before?
Compared to your...
Well, compared to other states.
Oh, yes. It's a lot smaller than other schools. But just, I mean, I can see an increase, but to triple it is a bit much.
As I recall, the tuition cost for a student in Texas is relatively low compared to other states.
People can come from other states and pay the out-of-state tuition and still get out cheaper.
Oh, man. Mm-hmm. We have a daughter at ELU, and one of the things that bothers me is that I feel like such a large majority of the students, they've become an upper-middle class student.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm frankly irritated just with the fact that this past year she's a junior. Through the mail comes Visa card, MasterCard, the department stores. There's no way I would sign these. They just send them to the students because they figure they're an upper middle class school. So evidently somebody's supposed to cover it if it gets overcharged. I'm irritated at the school making them call and say, where did they get the list of names? Get them somewhere. But it all sort of ties into, you know, and they tend to want clothes. And I don't like the image that's what our church schools have become.
I think they really make a supreme effort to try and enroll and recruit minorities at the colleges of the church. But as you know, that really gets very expensive. And
they make a supreme effort also with like Saudi Arabians, et cetera, because they can pick up the
okay.
I feel like I walk over there and it's an upper move.
Yeah, and I noticed the youth that I work with, and if they cannot afford to go to PLU, it is a downgrade to go to a state school. And I remember one of the arguments in our church was the scholarship fund only went to those students going to Lutheran schools. And that what about those students who spent, we had one girl who spent hours playing the organ for the church. The best school for her was out-of-state Arizona, a state school, but the scholarship fund wouldn't pay for it because it wasn't Lutheran. You know, so it's a downgrade.
Herman? The average income on students who go to private colleges in Iowa is lower than the average income of students who go to the state schools.
Iowa has a very good tuition sharing program in the state, which it'd be nice if other states could pick up on that basic idea. But it has to be in the state of Iowa.
California has more of it, too, than Washington. I feel like there are less choices.
Jim, that points to something I've become aware of, I think many in the room are, of another shift in the last 30 years. When I was a student in ALC College, over half of our students came from outside the state. It is Wartburg, and Herman would know the figures today. My guess is today 80% of the Wartburg students come from one state, Iowa.
That's right.
And that's because of the shift in funding. And that troubles me because I think the mix is less. The
right.
student body is more parochial.
Yep.
Iowans are good people. I am one. But I would really welcome the chance to go to school with people from outside of Iowa. And that's less true.
Yep.
I think it's happening everywhere as states pick up more of the funding of private college costs.
Right.
And I don't know what can be done about it, but it troubles me.
Well, church merger has something to do with that, too.
The 1960 merger?
Yeah. Before that, our college was serving the whole church across the country.
That's right.
And after the merger, all the other colleges.
It may get worse before it gets better. We're talking about a new church with a clustering of our colleges in the upper Midwest.
They become even more parochial in the
That'd
territory they serve.
I served on one of those committees as a consultant on one of those committees, and one of the things that I think the college presidents who were on the committee were concerned about was that the pool for students ought to be national. In other words, the publicity that comes out of the church ought to be for all the colleges, and the recruiting patterns ought to be nationwide in scope. Some folks will get a little uptight about that, especially if they had seen their college as synodically owned or a strong tie to a synod. And that works fine when you're the only college in one or several synods. But when you get to the upper Midwest, why, it really becomes a problem. Can we shift this a little bit to students? What are some of the challenges and the struggles that students face today?
Okay.
Yes?
Again, talking about somewhat the monetary issue, for students who say, there are some students who say, well, I'm going to school to get a better job, and I'm looking at this financially, and it's not paying off. The students that are saying, I'm going to school to better myself, and the return doesn't really make that much difference, and then keep hearing that college is not paying off, keep being told by other people, you went to 4 years of college and you're doing what? You're getting what? You're going to graduate school, and what are you going to get a better job because of that? And so that doesn't help.
Would it help if we didn't talk about it?
No, but I think that the church, for one, can do a lot more talking about some altruistic goals or some personal growth.
The non-economic values of education.
Right.
Yeah. That bothers me, it's all how much money we can make rather than how we can learn more in being more effective in serving. It's just the money.
Yes, when I'm reporting to you, there's what went on in different surveys. Mm-hmm. I agree with you. course I did that.
I haven't been here 1 week, but the village staff here at Holden seem to be a model for alternative. They are there and stand as living evidence of a significant life that has a different orientation. It's an inspiration to me.
Well, if Yuppie is your model, what are you going to expect out of high school students considering college? I mean, if a flashy car, if worldwide travel, if designer clothes, what are you going to expect? Rather than a servant model, rather talking about bettering yourself, rather than being interested in walking around and observing the little things. I mean, it doesn't take a genius to see the big things. Ed talked about the big light. Everybody sees the light, but who sees the flower? Part of higher education, it seems to me, is to help you to see things that other people don't take the time to look at, and then to marvel at those little things. And why do you marvel at it? Because somebody's peeled a few layers away, so that you get some idea of what in the world is involved in a thing called photosynthesis. What in the world is involved with a whole business of processing sunlight and some nutrients from the soil and some water that produces this fantastic creation called a flower. That's what I think, understanding a Rich Kammerer painting and learning to appreciate that. Even though it doesn't look like anything. I mean, you can't see a face. You get the point? Or to understand, we talked about dialectical materialism. You know, it's very easy to reinforce your prejudices and throw stones about anybody who has a different lifestyle or a different way of approaching life than you do. And hopefully, when you get into this whole arena of higher education, again, you can peel away some layers. And they used to talk about walking in the moccasins of your neighbor. You can't really understand until you walk in his moccasins or her moccasins. Well, in a sense, that's what higher education helps us to do. It helps us to broaden our understanding, not only of ourselves, but of our neighbors. And of course, that's partially what I think the gospel is talking about.
I'm sitting here thinking about my father, the struggles that he had in his life, He did everything the hard way, everything. He was a farmer in the Red River Valley. And he always preached to us as we grew up, seven of us, anything that's worth having is a struggle. Yeah. You have to work for it. And I think this is what our young people are not really taught today, that you have to work, you have to struggle a little to get where you want to do. You can't always have that car, all those nice travel. I can't get over it. I have two nephews that graduated from high school. What did they do right after high school graduation? Went on trips. I think our priorities are in the wrong place. In the church as well.
Yes, in the church and in the home. Just think about what message. If your parents taught you that about struggle and saving, what's being taught today? What have you taught your children? What have we taught our children? If this is important. Here are some folks who had some ideas about what life was about, and they said that struggle is like the common denominator. But again, it seems to me it depends on how in the world you look at that struggle, if the glass is half full or half empty. Our time is up. Narnia means that you have to claim your children over here now. My thanks to you. Tomorrow will be at a different time and a different channel, but we're going to talk a little bit about ideas tomorrow.